KNOM Update News. I'm Anna Rose MacArthur, and it's 9:02. As the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers finalizes details on the economic and logistical feasibility of its deepwater port recommendations, it's anticipating continued heavy development in northern and western Alaska. The plan expects not only increased vehicle traffic in the Bering Straits region, but offshore drilling in the Chukchi Sea and graphite production at a fledgling mining claim on the Seward Peninsula. Lorraine Cordova is with the Army Corps of Engineers and serves as the Deepwater Port Studies Economics Team Lead and Project Technical Lead. She says at present, the Corps is shoring up final details in the draft report.
Right now, we're working with our co-workers at U.S. Army Corps of Engineers headquarters to reach a tentatively selected plan. We're evaluating 19 different iterations of the Nome, Point Spencer, and Cape Riley locations. And once we reach a tentatively selected plan, we'll be able to better focus our efforts on the environmental impact statement, which will be part of the total draft feasibility study that should be ready for review the first week of March.
The final document will present Congress with a cost-benefit analysis on whether such a project is in the nation's best interest. Cordova says that, in her opinion, the addition of a deepwater port in western Alaska, in whichever configuration it ends up, is a net gain.
This is a viable project, and it definitely provides more benefits to the nation than it does, than it will cost. So we're hopeful to have this out on the street and into Congress's hands by December of 2014 so that they can make a decision to authorize and or fund the project.
If the federal government decides to pursue the Corps' recommendations, it would foot 65% of the bill for building. The other 35% would come from the project's chief sponsor, the state of Alaska. While details are not settled, Cordova says the focus of the draft report thus far is on different configurations in Nome and Port Clarence, which is the body of water near Teller, supporting Cape Riley on the eastern side and Port Spencer to the west. So it's a safe bet that if a port gets built, it'll be on the Seward Peninsula. And questions over where it gets put and by whom depend on what the Corps foresees in the region's 50-year economic forecast. The Army Corps of Engineers not only takes the current economic situation into account, but bases recommendations on predictions of expanding activity in different sectors. Cordova says their report anticipates heavy development projects in the Arctic region that would be served by nearby support facilities.
We've incorporated the Graphite One mine coming online and moving their graphite product out of the port of Nome. We've incorporated oil and gas exploration and production activity for Shell, Crowley, and Statoil, you know, assuming that if there was a deep draft port available for their use closer to their Chukchi and Beaufort Sea leases, that they would prefer to use that port.
The inclusion of Vancouver-based Graphite One's claim on the Seward Peninsula is highly speculative. The project's status is unclear. Although Jack DeMarkey with the Department of Natural Resources said in November, the company has not yet finished collecting its baseline environmental data. The company erroneously states in promotional materials that the claim's viability is supported in part by access to a deepwater port in Nome. It's unclear whether this is a technical misunderstanding of the port of Nome's capacity or speculative claim banking on future development. Graphite One has not responded to several months of repeated attempts over phone and email by KNOM for clarification on the project's status. For now, it appears the Army Corps of Engineers takes as a given in its 50-year plan that graphite will be mined near the Amaroq Basin, and oil companies will continue pursuing offshore oil drilling. Likewise, Graphite One's promotional material relies on not-yet-built infrastructure to bolster claims of economic feasibility. It's a reinforcing cycle in which anticipation over growth is self-perpetuating. Alaska will lose about 400 soldiers from the U.S. Army Alaska operations, and the announcement is being portrayed as good news for military officials in the state. GBER spokesman John Pinnell says Anchorage operations will lose 780 positions, but Fort Wainwright will gain 367, for a net loss of around 375 soldiers by the end of 2015. Pinnell says the positions will largely come from cutting smaller units within the 2nd Engineer Brigade. The cuts were not a surprise. They are part of the 80,000 soldier drawdown called for in the Budget Control Act of 2011, But Pinnell says if you consider losses in other parts of the nation, Kentucky's Fort Knox will lose 3,800 to 4,000 soldiers, an entire brigade combat team. The small cut to Alaska's military position is good news. Pinnell says the Army values Alaska's strategic position not only for the Arctic, but also for the entire Pacific theater. Pinnell also stressed that the smaller loss here is a reflection of the strong community support that Alaskans have always shown for the military. He says mostly positions will not be refilled as soldiers rotate out or retire. He says there will be some that will have their tours shortened, but that will be on a case-by-case basis. Next month, the World Wildlife Fund, an international environmental advocacy organization, is releasing a report on walrus ivory. Ernie Cooper is the director for the Traffic and Wildlife Trade Program at WWF Canada and is in charge of the pending report.
We've been conducting a study of international trade and management of walruses, looking at the global trade.
The study comes in the context of WWF's work with different governmental agencies and conservation groups combating illegal ivory trafficking across the globe, which for the most part means elephant ivory. But WWF decided to look at the market for walrus ivory in part because they expected there might be some overlap in the trade patterns. Cooper says what they found is that basically there's no reliable way of establishing numbers for what's going on with walruses.
One of the results is that it's very hard to get a really precise handle on international walrus trade for a couple of reasons, but partially because the majority of walrus ivory trade is in carvings. And it's not possible to quantify, you know, how many carvings equal one walrus. So the most basic question, how many walruses are in international trade, can't actually be answered in any real precise manner.
On top of the limitations of aggregating walrus numbers through carvings, there are just four countries in the world with walrus harvests: the U.S., Russia, Canada, and Greenland. Walruses aren't an endangered species, so there's no ban or record-keeping protocol for international sales of byproducts. And if there are regulatory mechanisms for tracking domestic scales on the four countries involved, which, in the U.S. at least, is not the case, those databases aren't shared, so there's no way of collecting the information. Cooper says that even amid barriers to their research, the preliminary findings simply didn't uncover anything illicit going on.
We weren't able to find much evidence of illegal trade in walrus.
Cooper is quick to caution, however, that there's a possibility researchers just haven't found a practical way of assessing the particular markets for walrus ivory.
The challenge there is that absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence.
What Cooper couldn't address was how ongoing efforts at eliminating market demand for ivory products might affect hunters and carvers in Alaska. Senator Mark Begich's recent letter to Interior Department Secretary Sally Jewell asked the agency to exercise restraint in upcoming policy recommendations on measures to combat illegal ivory trafficking. Begich's concern is that a broad sweeping condemnation of ivory products will negatively affect subsistence communities who rely on walrus ivory for income. Supporters of a citizen initiative to legalize the recreational use of marijuana in Alaska say they've submitted more than 46,000 signatures to the state elections office. If enough of the signatures are deemed valid, the question of whether to legalize pot in Alaska would appear on the August 19th primary ballot. If ultimately approved, Alaska would become the third state to legalize marijuana, following voter initiatives last year in Colorado and Washington State. Organizers only need about 30,000 signatures to get the issue before voters, but wanted to submit more than that to cover any challenges. State officials have 60 days to verify there are enough valid signatures to qualify for the ballot. And looking in on the price of gold in New York at this hour, gold is up 90 cents an ounce to $1,227.80 an ounce. Silver's up 2 cents an ounce to $19.64 an ounce. Zinc is at 91 cents a pound. It is unofficially 19 degrees outside the KNOM studios, coming up on 12 minutes after 9 o'clock.